right. So first, I would like you to say and spell your name for me and your title, please. You don't have to spell your title, though.
Thank you. Well, you know, be careful. Scientists and engineers sometimes are very direct people. So my name is Mark Mayberry, M-A-R-K, M-A-Y-B-U-R-Y. If you want to put the initial in, it's T for Thomas, as in the doubter. That makes me a good scientist.
That's true. That's in your nature. And what is your title?
I am the Chief Scientist of the United States Air Force.
Let's talk a little bit about your job. So what does it mean to be the Chief Scientist of the United States Air Force?
Well, it's a tradition. In fact, I'm actually talking to you from the von Karman table. The actual table we're sitting at right now was used by Theodore von Karman, who after World War II, Eisenhower came back and was shocked at the advances in technology that other forces had made, other countries had made. I mean, just as an example, jet engines from the Germans and V-2 rockets and things we didn't really understand, frankly. And so Hap Arnold, who is the head of the 1947, of course, when the Air Force is created. So it's just after that period. Basically, Hap went out to industry, to academia in particular, to Caltech, and got what he thought was the best top scientist in the country at the time, Theodore von Karman, who's an aerospace scientist. He basically was brought into the Air Force to help, to operate at the senior-most levels. So I'm a three-star equivalent, and I'm the 33rd. Up chief scientist. I like to joke to people, I'm not the first Mark. Mark Lewis, we call him Mark 31, was the first Mark. I'm not the first computer scientist, not even the first artificial intelligence scientist. Ed Feigenbaum, who's a professor emeritus at Stanford, was the first chief scientist in the Air Force who had an AI background. I am, however, the very first chief scientist who was a former uniformed personnel. So I'm a former Air Force officer. When I was a young man, I was a lieutenant. So the chief scientist, has this long history, a tradition of being brought in, hand selected by the secretary and the chief to come into the service for a few years to help advance, oftentimes, particularly strategic topics. So you act as the chief technical advisor to the secretary and the chief. You represent the Air Force to scientists across the interagency, industry, academia, national labs, federally funded research and development centers. And basically your job is to educate, to guide, alert, provide vectors for strategic vectors for ways forward across the entire service.
That's what I was going to ask, if you were basically an advocate for science and scientists in the Air Force.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Jessica. I don't actually use the word advocate. However, I am a champion. And I'm very careful in that because we are, by design, intended to be an independent, objective advisor. Even though we all have personal biases and experiences that shape the way we see things, especially the chief scientist is expected to be someone who's evidence-based, data-driven, objective, almost like I hate to use the analogy, but others have used it before, almost like, Spock on the, USS Enterprise. He or she, of course, is someone who's expected to be not only smart, but also have an operational empathy for the services and frankly, deep understanding. So yes, we do advocate in the sense of I'm the top senior most voice for science and technology in the Air Force. At the same time, sometimes science is not the solution. Sometimes it's a cultural challenge or it's a organizational challenge. Or it's a funding challenge, and it's not really a science issue. Now, all of those things relate. I mean, we have social sciences to help us understand organization behavior and structure and the like. But nonetheless, the scientist ought to be this sort of honest broker, independent, evidence-based wise person to help give sound advice to the Secretary and the Chief, and for that matter, other senior leaders in the Air Force.
Well put. And by the way, Spock was often referred to as Chief Science Officer Spock.
Good point, Jessica. And indeed, it's an interesting analogy. I frankly hadn't thought much about it, but one of our chief scientists, did a little piece, doing a comparison. And one of the interesting things about that is that, Spock was somebody who, when needed to, could sit in the captain's chair and drive the ship, right? So now I'm certainly never going to sit in the chief's or the secretary's position, but you have to have that level of understanding of their mission and, frankly, the operators. And so I've personally taken the last year and a half and spent a lot of time with operators. I spend time with scientists all the time, but I've gone out to fly in U-2s and F-16s and with the Hurricane Hunters, just so that I can empathize, with what their experience is, what their concerns are, and really, there's no, just like Spock being on the Enterprise, fighting the Klingons or discovering a new life form, that experience I think is very important, that you're there actually to provide sort of operational insight.
I agree, and I'm also a big fan of Spock. He often got Kirk out of a lot of trouble too, because Kirk would be like, "It'll be fine, Spock," and he's like, "Oh."
I don't know about that. Right? Exactly. No, that's true. And so now, unlike there are places where the analogy breaks down. I mean, Spock, of course, the eternal quest of whether or not he actually had a limbic system, that is, whether or not he had emotions and feelings and the like. I think, like a good medical doctor, you want to be objective rational. You also have to appreciate that there's an irrational, there's an emotional side of people and organizations, and that if you don't understand that, you don't have a holistic understanding of the environment. So it is important to, realize that, we need to have that holistic experience. He's a different life form too, so we have to recognize that.
Well, he's half human too.
He's half human too. Fair enough.
I should have put that in the email. I'm a huge science fiction fan.
Ah, wonderful.
If I don't gather myself back up, we're going to be talking Star Trek forever. And I watched a piece of the action last night, which is a great TOS episode. Anyway,
very good.
How did you get to where you are today? I mean, you don't just wake up and go, you know what I think I'm going to do is become the chief scientist of the United States Air Force.
Well, like a normal person, I went to college and went to grad school. And so, I got my undergraduate I got a Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics at Holy Cross. So I've personally always believed in the kind of balance of the arts and the sciences. It turns out there's a lot of neurophysiological evidence for why that's important now. We didn't know that, actually. Nobody really knew that 10, 20 years ago. But so anyways, I did my undergraduate work in math, was a valedictorian in my class, and as a result of that got a scholarship by the Rotary Foundation to go overseas and get my my master's in speech and language processing. Served at Griffiths Air Force Base as a laboratory research program manager. Continued my doctorate in artificial intelligence at Cambridge in England. Along the way, I got a master's in business, actually because I was getting very interested in leadership in the Air Force. After that, I decided that, ironically, I was afraid of getting shipped off to the Pentagon to become a program manager. And so I realized I really wanted to be a scientist, and I was good at inventing things and working with groups to do creative things and innovative things. And so I went off to MITRE, a federally funded research and development center, which ironically, come full circle, I realized the national labs and the FFRDCs were actually set up by, among other folks, some of the earlier chief scientists giving advice on how to get access to good talent back in the 50s and 60s. So anyways, I spent 20 years as a manager and executive at MITRE, wrote some books along the way, invented, got three patents contributed to a couple of defense science boards, and along the way got invited to join the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board. And in doing so, which is a great honor and really a great pleasure, a lot of hard work, very, very hard work on those studies. But I found them to be extremely fulfilling, especially sort of mid-career when you've had a lot of engineering experience, but you actually want to make a difference in the national scene. So, I mean, I got to meet some incredible people, you know, former directors of DARPA, you know, folks like Larry Lynn, many others, my own former boss, Bob Nesbitt, member of the Defense Science Board, and many others who really were instrumental in helping broadening my perspective on the world. And along the way, supporting the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, someone tapped me on the shoulder one day and said, "Hey, how'd you like to be chief scientist?" And what's really ironic is 10 years prior, I had been asked to be chief scientist, and my wife was ill at the time. Thank goodness she got better. I'll knock on the wooden theater von Karman table. And but at that time, I couldn't become chief scientist. So I actually thought I would never, I had a chance, and I thought I would never really have a chance again. And sure enough, 10 years later, they came back and asked me again, and I said, you know, absolutely. And so... it was a great experience. So that's kind of how you become, I mean, I think everybody comes along a different path, but that was my experience.
You know, in all of my life, nobody has ever tapped me on the shoulder and asked me if I wanted to be the chief scientist of the United States Air Force. It's really weird.
Well, you know, it is something that you don't volunteer for. You don't apply for it. It is a tradition. As I said, I'm 33rd. I will basically recommend the 34th. To the chief and the secretary. Ultimately, it's the chief's decision. The chief makes the recommendation to the secretary. I think you realize that if you really pick a perfectly aligned person for the job, I mean, just think back to your images of Spock, right? If you get the right guy in the job or gal, they're going to have a strategic impact. And so I don't think it's something like you said, Jessica. It's not something that you wake up when you're young. Although I would tell you, I knew people call me crazy, but I knew in high school that I wanted to study artificial intelligence. And I think I probably knew when I was around 15 that and you might have been seeing Star Wars when you go being inspired. I think there is something about science fiction that does inspire young scientists. But I think it also might have just been about, you know, I was so fascinated with human intelligence and these computers that were becoming more and more. I mean, they still were pretty rickety when I was a young man, but they had this really interesting gleam of sophistication and ability to learn and ability to respond to their environment that I just thought that was and more interestingly that I thought it was a great tool to better understand human intelligence. So that's kind of what got me interested in my scientific vector, and then along the way I got interested in people and leading and managing. I think to do this job effectively, you do also have to be someone who has excellent interactions with other people and an ability to, you know, deal with stress, obviously, and overwhelming amounts of information and opportunities. So I think management and leadership, in fact, even my early Air Force training helped in that regard, because, you know, we try to develop, you know, men and women to lead others, and that's an important skill.
Sounds like you sort of have to be a polymath to really to be good at this job in some ways, because you seem to be very well-versed in quite a few things.
Well, it's an interesting observation, Jessica. My parents used to call me the Renaissance man when I was a kid, because I liked music, I liked art, I wasn't very good at art, but I liked it. I was pretty good at music, and I was okay at athletics, and I loved, like, any subject. It wasn't like, you know... I mean, actually, at the time, I found writing to be most difficult, and I just think it's because I happen to have a really brilliant teacher, instructor. I never realized until now. I mean, one of my early math teachers was one of the original members of the Harvard Calculus Project, Mr. Pasquale, and happened to be lucky to have in a public high school a brilliant math teacher, and he wasn't alone. There were others as well. I think by inspiring kids, we know now from neuroscience that kids who develop, you know, both, you know, right, left, left brain, right brain, that is, you know, their frontal lobe, more mathematical, logical reasoning, as well as the ability to do, to have visual intelligence in their, in the back of their brain, in their occipital lobe, but also the ability to have linguistic skills in their, in the side of their, the Broca regions, sort of, you know, just above your ear. We know now from brain science that, that these co-developments are extremely important, and we shouldn't tell kids, you know, you're not good in math or you're not good in drawing or whatever. We ought to encourage them to be as good as they can be. Some kids may have natural talents, but it turns out that all those, you know, cylinders firing, to mix our, my metaphors, simultaneously is what empowers the brain. We even know now that the limbic system, which is the more, you know, closer to the brain stem, you know, below your cerebellum, that that actually now has significant effects on your ability to not only understand your emotions, you know, feel, sense, react, but also it affects your memory and it affects your ability, your ability to perform recall. So I think we're still learning, but I think it's really important. You know, polymath, if you will, to use your term, I think of them as multiple intelligences. We need to develop, whether it be in our scientists or, frankly, our operators, we need to develop that kind of multidimensional intelligence because it actually helps deal with very complex problems.
Ooh, multidimensional intelligence. I like that.
Yeah. Now, that's not my, that's the, well, that's kind of my modern term of it. But, you know, it goes back to one of my favorite authors, Howie Gardner, who's a Harvard professor, who back in the 80s wrote a very influential book called The Theory of Multiple Intelligences. And it was a fascinating book to me because, you know the classic example, and people think a little bit differently now, but when I was going through high school, and certainly probably a decade before I went to high school, there was sort of the jocks and the nerds, right? And so, like, you're either a nerd and you're kind of a bookworm and you're really smart, or you're a jock and, you know, you're not smart, and physically effective. It turns out, actually, that we find Olympians who are straight-A students. Well, how can that be, right? That nerd jock doesn't make sense. Well, actually, it makes a lot of sense. And Howie Gardner saw this many, many decades ago, and he talked about kinesthetic intelligence. So the ability to actually physiologically sense and react very quickly, very expertly. And now I'm a USA hockey coach, level 4 USA hockey coach for youth hockey, and we talk about brain building neuromuscular skills, and, you know, that means brain physics, right? I mean, it's both, and we know actually getting kids, particularly girls, developmentally between the ages of about 11 and 13, and then boys between the ages of like 13 to 15, that sweet spot of 12 in girls and 14 in boys is where their neuromuscular development is really taking off. It's exponentially growing. And so that's why it's so important to get kids in terms of learning very early on. That doesn't mean that you can't learn when you're 50 or 60 or 70. The brain is just as elastic, we're learning now, at that age as before. But what Howie Gardner wisely told us, now, you know, he's a cognitive psychologist, what he realized behaviorally was kids could develop multiple intelligences. They could be good at logical, mathematical things, good at sociological things, good at physiological things, and good at visual things. So all of these intelligences weren't necessarily exclusive. In fact, they were interdependent, but that we ought to develop them maximally in each child and each adult.
So, oh God, I'm going to derail my own train. But I have discovered, I know a lot of people who are very technical that also have like degrees or interest in philosophy, and I always found that to be a very strange connection. At first, and I realized it sort of makes sense in many ways. I have several friends who are computer scientists that have degrees in philosophy, and I was like, that is really, you wouldn't think those two things would go hand in hand, but.
Well, actually, Jessica, what is philosophy? Philosophy is the love of knowledge. What do scientists do? We create knowledge. And so, it's the exact perfect match. It was ironic, as one of the hardest course I ever took as an undergraduate was philosophy. I took it from a German philosopher, and oh boy, I'm just lucky I got out alive of that class. It was, but I tell you, it was to me, it was the reason I took it is because I was so and was during the course and after the course so fascinated with the study of knowledge. And so, you know, whether it's the history of science you're interested in, or whether it's just doing science better or having better reflection on your own science, philosophy is very, very important. I mean, you know, it gets into fundamental questions like, you know, how do you know you really has observed something? You know, people come out and say, hey, I saw it. Well, you know, now we know that, you know, expert witnesses, or not expert witnesses, but eyewitnesses, experience epiphenomenal things. They see things that they don't, that aren't actually there, and later they remember things that didn't happen. And so that's understanding just that experience, which is central to science and discovery, is enriched, is deepened by studying philosophy. So I think it's not at all surprising that there's that connection. You're right, though. At first glance, you're like, what the heck do these do each other? Just like, why would you bother having a scientist learn how to write stories or learn how to draw? And you don't realize, actually, that creativity, improvisation, is visual thinking, visual transformation, dealing with occlusion and vision. These things are actually all about perception and reaction, which is fundamentally things you need to do when you're a scientist.
What kind of what presents some challenges in your job? What are some things that you find to be interesting challenges being the chief scientist?
Well, you know, there are a lot of particular challenges. I mean, every day as chief scientist, you are forced with an embarrassment of riches in terms of both problems and opportunities. So I think the biggest challenge is the breadth of the and the criticality of the science and technology issues across the whole enterprise. You know, across air challenges, challenges in space, challenges in cyberspace, and the need for you as the chief scientist to very rapidly get to the essence of oftentimes breathtaking science. And then the important need to distill down into very clear and practical courses of action what you need to do to move forward. You know, again, using that, I hate to use the Spock analogy. I don't often use that, this, by the way, but you know, since it's come up, you know, how do you quickly realize, you know, what threat is coming at the Air Force or at the nation? How do you forecast what threat might come to the nation? And how you might respond to that in 5 or 10 years, so that's science fiction, imagination, and yet at the same time it's needing to be realistic about, you know, what could happen and what won't likely happen. So I think that's really probably one of the greatest challenges. The good news is, unlike von Karman back, you know, over 50 years ago. Where he was the one scientist. I mean, we didn't even have a laboratory. You can imagine, like today, you know, some people say, oh my gosh, you have such a tough job because you're the one guy who has to answer to the chief and secretary this. And we're talking questions about hypersonics, to questions about sensors, to questions about human effects, to questions about cyberspace. It's just a huge span of everything from materials and physics to human nature. I mean, it is breathtaking. But the advantage I have, unlike von Karman, is I actually have about 50 scientists, senior scientists, chief scientists in their own right, around the Air Force. So I've got at each of the major commands, Dr. Janet Fender at Air Combat Command. I've got Dr. Darn Erbschlow, who's a former military assistant, actually, of this office at the Air Mobility Command, and so on. We have a variety Dr. Doug Beeson at Space Command. So at each of the major commands, we have a chief scientist. And then within the laboratory, in each of the scientific areas, we have scientists. And so, you know, being a good collaborator and communicator is really important. That's a big challenge. Maintaining connectivity with everyone is a challenge. And frankly, reaching out. You know, I may have some exciting new scientific opportunity, but I got to get that out to academia or industry. And so one of the ways I've done it in my job is I've realizing that you can easily get buried in the and sort of drowned in the day-to-day sort of taskings and questions. Is I pick every year I pick a strategic topic. So the first year I came in working with the Secretary and the Chief, I asked them what their big concerns were, and we ultimately decided to work on energy horizons, and I articulated a vision for energy for the Air Force called Energy Horizons. And then in this last year, I've worked on cyberspace, and we've come up with a Cyber Vision 2025, which is our vision in the near, mid, and far term of where the Air Force had a lead, follow, or watch technology in cyberspace. And I'll probably work my third and final year on yet another strategic topic to be determined. So that's one of the ways I manage the kind of tactical versus strategic balance of this job, which is one of the challenges.
So I want to talk about your doctorate in artificial intelligence, because I saw that when I was reviewing and I was like, yee! So does that mean that you work with robots, have worked with robots, and do you have any robots you've built that...
I am a robot. No. The irony is actually, in terms of working with robots, I actually work mostly with humans day to day. So my doc. So first of all, I should explain my doctor's in artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, like computer science, is a really big field. And while robots are oftentimes the sort of popular, in instantiation of AI, AI is kind of means lots of things. So it certainly means is reflective in the means of communicating, understanding and speaking language or reading and writing. It's certainly reflective in the ability to see, like a robot would be able to speak and see, but also the ability to understand and plan, whether it be physical motion or plan activities. So robots oftentimes embody much of intelligence, but we have intelligence in lots of things. In your automatic braking system, you have an intelligent sensor that responds to the way you brake in the surface conditions of the road, such that you don't have to pump your brakes anymore. In fact, I had to relearn when I was teaching my kids, my first generation kids and my second generation kids. Our eldest came into being when brakes were still manual. So I had to teach him how to pump brakes. I'm from the Boston area, and so, we get, lots of ice storms and about 4 or 5 accidents first day of storm. So point is, AI is in part sometimes embedded intelligence in the devices we have. In other cases, it's embodied in robots. So in the Air Force, even more so than robots, in fact, actually the Army is probably the biggest significant adopter. They have over 5,000, maybe it's not 10,000 robots in operation. You look at some of the PAC robots and the like were used for bomb disposal. These are very popular. In the Air Force, our AI tends to be embedded. So we call it, in fact, autonomy, where we're looking at things, for example, in the air or in space, in cyberspace, where actually we already have a kind of AI, if you can think of it as, in our systems. So, for example, our satellites will know when to they sense and know when to automatically go into a safe mode when they're in danger. We have aircraft that can automatically take off and land, so they sense and they respond, obviously, to those actions, those situations. We have, of course, automatic navigation. We have automated defenses in our computing infrastructure. The Pentagon I'm sitting in right now is the most attacked building in the world, and the OODA loop is measured in milliseconds. So 25 milliseconds is the line speed of our sensors, and so we need to be able to respond that quickly. Well, humans can't even sense that quickly. And we're talking about sensing and thinking and acting in that kind of a time frame. So clearly that's going to require some intelligence, automated intelligence. As you can see, longer term, we're working on things that will allow our systems to not only self-repair, but also to self-assemble, to actually self-organize. That's a kind of social intelligence that people oftentimes don't think about. When they think of robots, they think of like individual things that can go out and, you know, shine their shoes or drive the enterprise. They don't necessarily think about things that can go out and organize other robots. And that, you know, is frightening to some people and certainly has to be controlled. But it's also the case that that there are a number of scientists working on not only self-assembly, but self-repair, self-organization. So a good example of that might be if we're flying a swarm of aircraft, you don't want them to crash into one another, right? Just a simple separation in 3D space. And that's something actually in the last couple of years we've been able to demonstrate. So these are some of the aspects of AI. My actual doctorate, to directly answer the question, was I created the first computer program to write multi-paragraph text in multiple languages. So working from formal knowledge bases, databases, I actually studied humans, how humans teach other humans to write. And I didn't really learn how to write until I had done that, which is kind of ironic. As I'm writing my thesis, I'm, you know, learning about how people teach other people how to write. So that was my actual, if you will, innovation as my contribution to knowledge as a doctorate student.
I'm sorry, I was writing that down. You created the first program to write what in multiple languages?
Multi-paragraph text. So for example, we had created computers that could write sort of single sentences, so that, you know, they understand syntax and they understand agreement and they understand you know, punctuation, all the things that you need to understand to write a sentence. But what I had worked on were studying how human beings, for example, teach other humans to write comparisons, to write descriptions, to write stories, to write arguments, and all of those genre, all of those forms of writing. Comparison, description, narrative, argumentation, all have, if you will, standard methods. In fact, my daughter right now is learning how to write some of her first arguments, right, as a 12-year-old. And she's been taught this is a topic sentence, this is what it means to make a point, this is evidence for that point, and so on. And so I basically taught computers how to do that. Just as you know, one example, there are three ways you can compare things. And there are only three ways you can compare things. You can compare them, you can describe them in turn, describe A, then describe B, and then compare and contrast them. You can describe them by their attributes. You know, if you compare an apple and orange, you can compare their color and their shape and their size and their weight and so on. That's called comparison by features or attributes. And then you can compare their similarities and differences. You can say, well, you know, both apple and an orange are fruit. And they both taste good, but they're different because they have different colors and they're, you know, different viscosity or whatever. So the point is there are three ways to do it. So we taught computers how to do that. So now, you know, forevermore, computers can compare things. So that's an example of kind of an empirical approach to AI where you go out and you study natural intelligence, see how natural intelligence works, collect a bunch of data, and then you use that to inspire you to create programs that can replicate that intelligence.
Well, thanks for doing that for us, you know, on the computers. We appreciate it.
Well, actually, ironically, I think it was, although I failed to go back to the education system, but I think actually one of the biggest benefits of creating artificial intelligence is it helps you actually understand better your natural intelligence. Now, I actually am a better writer and a better teacher of others to write now, because when they come to me and they say, "Hey, Dad," or "Hey, neighbor," how do I, you know, my kid's having difficulty with this essay. I can say, "Well, that's okay. This is what these are the ways to do it: A, B, C." And you know, let's talk about the things you, let's say for a comparison, you want to compare. And if they're really different, well, you probably should describe them in turn. If they're really similar, maybe you ought to describe them by attribute, or if what's important about them is their similarities and differences, use the third method. So, anyways, I think that's a particular value of AI is we originally thought, oh, we'll replace humans, and everybody's like, oh my goodness, the robots are going to take over, and there are still people, right, talk about the singularity, you know, they worry about this, But what I am continually inspired by is human creativity, innovation, improvisation, socialization. I mean, all these things that are innately human, that I think are can be frankly amplified by artificial intelligence.
Can you tell me a little bit about some interesting research projects or technologies that are being developed right now by the Air Force?
There are lots. There are things that range from the very, very practical, our ADVENT program, which is a new engine. We're about to test in FY13. Actually, two companies, Woolworth North America and General Electric, are both creating new jet engines, which actually have third flow, which means instead of having conventional two flows of air paths coming through the engine, they have a third one that can be turned on or off. And that's important because what it allows us to do is have basically, I call it in my layman's terms, a two-for-one. You get an engine that can either be high performance, and give you lots of thrust by clamping down on the flow, or by letting the flow go through your engine, be much more efficient. So if you're just, say in your fighter jet, you're loitering over a target or observing, to protect some ground force, you can save energy. We spent $9 billion on fuels last year in the Air Force. And any fuel variations, you know, when you go to the pump and you're like, oh, good, it's only three, like last night I filled up, it's only $3.79, right? And then, you know, the next day you go back and say, oh my gosh, it's $4.10 a gallon. So we have to absorb those fluctuations. So this is an example of technology that will result in, on the average, 25% more efficient jet engines. Which, interestingly, both those companies will roll back those innovations into the commercial base. So imagine paying, a quarter less for your plane ticket sometime down the road. So that's an example of a technology we're working on. Another example is, I mentioned we had a Presidential Early Career Award for Science and Engineering, the PCAS Awards. In 2012, this year, just a month or so ago, Dr. Matt Squires, who's from our vehicles directorate in the lab, he's one of 96 presidential awardees in the country. And he's developed a thing called cold atoms. I don't know if you've heard these, but you know one of our biggest problems in our defense is our dependence on global positioning system. I mean, it's both a great capability but also a great vulnerability. So what we are developing are alternatives to GPS. And so what cold atoms do is basically they're using a laser, you're able to basically remove a lot of the thermal artifacts of an atom, basically in a small container, which then we can use to essentially measure the movement of that atom as the vessel in which it moves in, you know, a pitch, yaw, and roll, right, in sort of the XYZ axis. And also measure the time based on the movement of that atom. So basically, we can get very good precision navigation timing measurements right from within a little box. So making that cheaper and faster and accurate is what Matt Squires is doing, and that'll revolutionize, you know, geopositioning. Imagine someday, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, where you're, you know, iPhone, your BlackBerry, your individual device knows where it is all the time, without reference to any global satellite. Another example of amazing technology is we're developing new sensors for our remotely piloted aircraft. I mean, that's in itself has been a transformation in the Air Force. Gorgon Stare, for example, new set of sensors which we'll put on our which we have put on some of our remotely piloted aircraft, which allow us to look at 4x4 kilometer pictures on the ground, give us, instead of a single soda straw view of a, you know, tracking, let's say, you know, a particular vehicle moving through a city, imagine being able to see a very large scale area where we could have as many as 65 two frames per second videos going on simultaneously. So that's a real sort of amazing advance forward. Another example is directed energy. We do some really exciting things. I've actually been shot by a high-power microwave, and the sensation of that high-power microwave is, which only penetrates, because we've done very, very careful human studies on this. Believe me, the chief scientist, if he didn't have very high confidence in the science and the engineering, both, wouldn't have subjected himself to this. But basically, this high-power microwave penetrates your skin only about 1/32nd of an inch. So very, very narrow penetration. If you're wearing contact lenses, it won't affect your contact lenses. It just basically makes you feel within about 2 to 3 seconds like you've fallen asleep on an August day on a beach and are significantly burned. So, and yet it actually doesn't do any damage to you. So as soon as this non-lethal device is turned on, if someone's, let's say, running toward an embassy or toward a base, an entry point, the notion is you can turn on this, what's called an active denial system, stop somebody in their tracks, and essentially non-lethally control their access. Interestingly, last year, one of our officers, Lieutenant Colonel Laura Barnes, received a special commendation medal from the United Kingdom Defense S&T Laboratory. She was the first non-UK person to receive that award. And the award, she got that award for laser bioeffects, because whether it be high-power microwaves or lasers, we in the Air Force have probably the world's best knowledge on that science and technology. So those are a couple examples. The coolest thing, though, there are many cool things we're working on. One, I think, very important one is could actually be revolutionary for all many Americans. You may know that 1.5 million Americans suffer from, I think it's called binocular degeneration, which is ocular degeneration, which is monocular degeneration, which is basically a loss of photoreceptors in the back of their eyes. Well, which of course can lead to blindness or just partial sight loss. We're funding, together with ONR, the Office of Naval Research, a group at Stanford that's runs a project called the BioX Project. And what that is doing is pretty amazing. Imagine you put a pair of glasses on, and you're partially blind, and into the glasses, a regular electro-optical, just a camera, right, takes in those images, and then those glasses then convert those images into laser beams. Those laser beams, very, very small, fine-grained laser beams, have been shot onto a small chip that's surgically implanted in the back of one of these people's eyes who are suffering from this degenerative disease. And on the front of that chip, in the back of the individual's eyes, are photovoltaics, or basically solar cells. And the solar cells then convert to what's in the back of that chip, which are basically electrodes. So the conversion basically goes from the image to a laser to a photoreceptor to a conversion to electricity into the optical nerve. And what this gives is a wireless communication between essentially the glasses and the individual's eye, which reduces infection, et cetera. There actually is in Northern Europe a biomedical device right now on the market in test that is a wired version of this. This is the world's first wireless version. And you can imagine what that could do for, you know, all Americans, but you can also imagine if we can give people superhuman vision. You know, we talk about science fiction. I can remember the $6 million man as a young boy, you know, watching that on television. And, you know, you had that astronaut, you know, who was you know, lost, you know, limbs and eyes, right, and ears. And this isn't entirely science fiction. I mean, already today we have people with pacemakers implanted in them. We have listening, hearing devices. When I was a young man 25 years ago working on my doctorate, actually was developing digital signal processing that, among other things, could be used in earpieces for speech recognition. And so this really is becoming revolutionary. And, of course, it's not only for people who might be disadvantaged, but also for providing, if you will, super perceptual capabilities, you know, enhancing people's ability to see, hear, sense things. So that's another example of kind of a revolutionary technology we're developing.
They're Jordy's visor. It's Jordy's visor.
Yeah, exactly. No, I hadn't thought about that, but indeed, now what's interesting about that is you know, we humans are very limited, and are, you know, humans are amazing, and yet we're extremely limited. We all talk about human limitations, but you know, individual limitations, but we as a species are limited, right? We can only see electro-optically. I mean, there are creatures on this earth, moths and others, that can perceive other frequencies, right? They can see other non-visible frequencies, infrared, sort of heat-seeking creatures that hunt in the night, for example, and/or there are creatures that can see other parts of the frequency spectrum. And so this could be, I think this is actually potentially a very interesting development in terms of enhancing our own species. Imagine a firefighter being able to walk up to a, you know, burning building and discover where that kid, what room the baby was left in. Now, you have to balance this, obviously, with privacy considerations, and we're very aggressive in the Air Force about having independent review boards and ensuring that we protect the privacy of individuals. But at the same time, we also realize that in certain catastrophic events or wartime events, that some of these technologies could be instrumental to success.
Not to geek this conversation up again, but there's this episode of this is what it reminded me of. There's an episode of The Next Generation where Geordi is on this destroyed. I don't know if it was a vessel or I think it was a spaceport or something, and it was destroyed. It was a scientific facility that was in orbit around this planet, and there were like three people, and Geordi's walking through this cavern, and he's going, oh, this is here, there's this heat signature, and this is all there, and watch out for that Riker. And they're like, how can you see this? And he remotes his visor into the main screen of the Enterprise, and you can see that he can see what everybody else can't, so he can see these heat signatures and all that stuff. And I was like, that is pretty amazing. And he was like, yeah, it's okay.
So we have, I should send you, we have a cool, this might be nice for your podcast since it's online. We can send you a pointer to a video that I use, which shows one of our remote teams, basically one of our special operation teams. This is all unclassified, but it's one of our advertisements for the Air Force. But it's a really nice illustration because it's very real about how you can have a remotely piloted aircraft flying over a location, seeing things with its sensors, sending those back to the team, to the remote team that's just landed, but doing that through a satellite, which then also goes to a command center. So that actually, that Hollywood example, in part, not entirely, but in part exists today in the Air Force, which is really amazing. Now typically what you're dealing with are infrared sensors, you know, so the folks are you know, wearing their night goggles, and or the aircraft are actually fixated with those. But there's a nice little 30-second clip that I should send you that I think you'll enjoy.
Oh, absolutely. And that's another thing that I wanted to ask you is with all these amazing advancements and all of the technology you've had the opportunity to either create or be a part of the creation, what is one thing that you're hoping to see or accomplish during your tenure as Chief Scientist of the U.S. Air Force? What would you like to look back and say, yes, that's what I did?
Well, as I mentioned, Energy Horizons, which was our vision for where energy needs to go in the air and space and on the ground for the Air Force, and then finally Cyber Vision, you know, so our vision for the Assured Cyber Advantage to make sure that we have both assured and empowered operators, that those operators are operating in cyberspace in a fashion that's both resilient and secure and agile, as well as ensuring that they have, you know, trusted foundations of hardware and software. So energy and cyber are two of the key things that I think we've helped with during my tenure.
And if you were a mad scientist, what one thing or device would you create and why?
Well, I'm actually a very happy scientist, so I don't know how mad scientists think. But certainly one of the things we ought to worry about are weapons of mass destruction. You know, and as you know, these could take the form of nuclear, chemical, biological kinds of threats. You know, there are lots of ways to counter that mad scientist, including much better intelligence, better readiness to deal with this, making our systems more robust and resilient, even allowing us to fight through such a dastardly attack. Interestingly, there is one thing we have created that you might find interesting, which is from the defense against, if you will, a mad scientist. So let's imagine somebody uses a chemical or biological weapon. Well, one of the things we've recently created, working together with the United States Transportation Command and Air Mobility Command, is a system called the Joint Biological Attack Defeat System, or JBADS. And basically the way it works is it allows you to bring in an aircraft vehicle or any kind of equipment, and we blast basically about 160 to 180 degree temperature through the system at a very high humidity rate. So if you heat things up more than about 185 degrees, you destroy their, you know, the components. If you anything below that, less than about 150 degrees, you know, the reason you boil water, right, is to get kill the bugs, right? So imagine somebody's decontaminated, or you've flown through a contaminated area, or walked through a contaminated area. What can you do? Well, it turns out that by having very high humidity and high temperature, basically gives you a greater than 6 log elimination of very hard to kill persistent biological agents. And the way it works is, I'm not a physicist, but the way the physicists explain this to me is enthalpy, which is the amount of energy captured, is in very low humidity air, like, you know, if you take 170 degree dry air, it gives you about 77 kilojoules per kilogram of energy. Whereas if you basically put that up to a very high humid, like a 90% humidity rate, that same temperature, 170 degrees, you get like 2,400 kilojoules per kilogram. So this, by the way, reminds me of being in Boston when it's really hot and humid. It's just, you know, people are like, oh, it's only 95 degrees. Yeah, but the humidity is so bad, right? Well, it turns out that it's not only uncomfortable for us, it turns out it's uncomfortable for bugs, that high humidity with high temperature. So that's an example of something that we have actually created, because you know, it's really the case that there'll always be bad people in the world, and we're going to need to defend against them.
And I have one more strange question for you. If you could go anywhere in time and space, where would you go and why?
Oh boy, I'd go back to Renaissance Italy in Florence, and that's because I'm biased, because I went to school as an undergraduate. I spent a semester abroad living with an Italian family and studying in Florence. But actually, there's a connection. I certainly didn't make it at the time, but as I look back now, Florence in the age of the Renaissance was an area which blended science, blended up the arts, blended philosophy, like we were talking about at the beginning, economics. I mean, so the social sciences and the hard sciences really were brought together in an extraordinary way. And obviously we have, you know, great artists like Michelangelo, great scientists like Leonardo, and many others who just innovated and invented in so many ways, architecturally, scientifically, medically. And I think while that was not the birth of science, one might argue perhaps only before with the Greeks, but certainly that was a golden age of multidisciplinary, of transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary research. Although it wouldn't have been called that then, it would have been called, you know, the Renaissance Age, the rebirth. So I think that's probably where I'd go. I mean, there are lots of other places I'd like to go in time, but I think that would be a very interesting.
That would. I too would find that really fascinating. I would love to, if I could speak, you know, Italian, which I might have to do some prep work before I traveled back in time, that would probably be one of the places I would go as well.
Well, fortunatamente io posso parlare italiano, so there's no problem with me. And my favorite food is tortellini, Alfredo, so I would not suffer
Well, we are about in our, we're a little over our hour time, but is there anything else that, do you have anything else that you would like to add? Anything, closing remarks, sir?
No, I just, it's a real honor and pleasure to be the chief scientist. It's an exciting job. It's an exciting time in our history. And, you know, certainly one of the, you know, hopefully there's some young viewer out there who's maybe thinking about a career in science. And if not a young viewer, a parent out there who listens. And I think it's really important, both because our economic success in America in terms of wealth generation is founded in manufacturing and science and engineering, but also our military prowess is fundamentally tied to the success of our industrial base, the success of our academic institutions, the success of our national laboratory and federally funded research and development centers. And I think in final analysis, it's the people, it's the American people. And so I think, you know, right now we are only producing a third of our graduates, our scientists and engineers. And you look at Asia, Asia's producing two-thirds scientists and engineers. So when we worry about things like offshoring or worry about, you know, reduction in GDP and the like, the answer, in my view, is, you know, science doesn't have all the answers, but it has many answers. And I think we've been blessed with a president and an administration who's really invested in, and frankly, an Air Force, who's invested in and sustained, even in our under economic pressures, strong investment in our seed corn. I mean, I just heard the Deputy Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff speak at our AFA conference last week, where I had the pleasure to speak on STEM. And that would be the last thing I'd leave with your viewers is you know, my Dr. and Mrs. Mabry, our two sons, are, you know, are already successfully launched their careers in science. And I think there's economic opportunity there, and there's national security in that area. And I think we need to foster that and encourage that.
Well said, and I agree. And on that note, I think I am done. I think we're done here. But I do want to find a way to schedule a time to do a story with you specifically about STEM and getting children involved in that as well. So
absolutely. Love to do that.
Yes, excellent. Okay, well, do you have any more questions for me or anything? Do you have anything?
No, Jessica. This has been delightful to hear about your interest in science fiction. And our challenge is to make that a reality.
Oh, I can't wait. When you I don't know if you're familiar with Doctor Who. That's my favorite show. But if you
Yeah, absolutely. No, I went to grad school in England.
You know,
I did my master's in Cambridge, and so I had known about Doctor Who well before then. But Doctor Who is a little bit quirky, right? You know, it's a little bit, you know, sometimes less believable. But what's interesting about science fiction is, and Doctor Who is a great illustration of this, it forces us to imagine things which are unimaginable. And you look at them and you're like, that couldn't happen.
And, that's true.
And then all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, we have global positioning. You know, we thought about global positioning back in the 50s and 60s. That's when science first started thinking about these things. So sometimes it takes a long time for these things to become a reality. I guarantee you nobody but the military, especially the Air Force, but certainly their services are concerned, are worried about positioning without, you know, GPS, just as an example. So I think, you know, science fiction does play an important role to force us to think beyond the today.
And if the Air Force ever develops a sonic screwdriver, I would like to put my name down to have one of those, please.
That's right. Well, fortunately, we don't manufacture things, so, you know, we'd have to find an industrial partner to actually build it so you could buy it.
That's fine, but, you know, in case that technology, you know, magically becomes available, I would like to, you know, put my name on some list somewhere to get one.
There you go. All right. Well, we'll sign you up, Jessica.
Well, thank you so much. Well, Dr. Mabry, it was a pleasure meeting you and speaking with you and picking your brain a little bit. You're an amazing, fascinating person and scientist, and it was an absolute honor to interview you today.
Thank you for what you do, Jessica. I appreciate it. It's so important to get the word out about science.
I agree.
So thank you.
All right. Well, you have a good, well, almost afternoon.
Roger that. Okay. Thanks, Jessica.
Okay. Bye.